second of two oral arguments this morning on Zoom.gov. It's May 19th, 2021. Marshall, will you call the next case?
Case number 820-1635, Mary Jane Gross versus Prestige Parking and Valet LLC.
Thank you. Counsel, let me just run over a few of our procedural rules, which are very much the same as they are in our physical courtroom, with which I know you're both familiar. Each of you will have 15 minutes for argument, and counsel for appellant, you'll have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal. I'd ask you to, you know, introduce yourself at the beginning of each of your arguments, because we are recording these and making the recordings available on our public website. And please keep your videos on, but your even when you're not talking, but your mute yourself when you're when the other counsel is speaking. So with that, whenever you're ready, counsel for appellant.
Michael Bryan on for the appellant. This is an interesting case. And from the very beginning when I got it, it's been one that's troubled me. But there's three issues that I think are important. And I think were issues that either the district court missed or should have ruled differently. The first issue is the actual theft of the car is the actual negligence. The defendant or the respondent, they were negligent in allowing this car to be stolen. And as a result, and it was foreseeable for them that someone in the hospital that would have the car there would have an effect. So based upon that, I submit that there should have been a basic claim to begin with just for that action in and of itself. That's the first part. Second part is the direction the district court took it, is that this was only a negligent infliction of emotional distress case. And so when we got to that point, then the question is one, whether or not there was a physical injury or if it was just a mental injury. We submit that under the information that we got from her doctor, Dr. Boss, and also her testimony as far as the effect goes, that there was a physical injury. So based upon a physical injury and the first step of Quill, or the first element of Quill, that we should have been allowed to go forward, even if that is what this case had to be described as.
Mr. Bryant, let me just ask you there. I'm looking at the complaint you filed, which alleges the negligence of permitting the Buick to be stolen, and then argues as a direct result of that negligence, your client has suffered from severe anxiety with physical and emotional symptoms. I mean, it seems to me that you pled this case out as an emotional distress case with attendant physical manifestations. Now it sounds like you're making a different pitch, saying, no, this really was a physical injury claim with attendant emotional distress. Well, how was this case pled out?
I think we could have both, though. I think you could have a simple negligence claim with damages, which is basically what we pled, which is a negligence claim with damages. Or if you get to the point of where it's required for it to be a negligent inflection of emotional distress claim, that we have physical damages as a result. So I think we can get both. I don't think that there's a limitation on making both those claims. Did you have a follow-up or?
No, you could proceed. I know you have a third issue you want to apprise the court of.
Okay. And then the third issue is this zone of danger issue. That if you decide it's not just a negligent claim, you decide that it's negligent infliction of emotional distress, and you have to get to, as a result of finding that there's no physical injury, that you get to the zone of danger. And our argument is that based on everything that happened in this case, and it's a different case. I mean, I don't expect that this will be a case anything like it. I mean, I was looking at the other cases that we're looking at, and there's always a potential for buildings blowing up or horses. I guess we don't see as many horses coming across roads as you used to, but I mean, even Paul's graph, I mean, you look at that, you can see that potentially happen again. I don't expect this is something that happens or will happen again. But when that's all being said, when you have the person come to her house and they follow up because the stuff that's in the car based upon it being stolen, I'd submit that we can get to zone of danger if we have to get that far, but we don't need to get that far to even get there.
Did you argue, Mr. Bryant, in the district court that the zone of danger element is met here?
Yeah, I did.
And what facts, or maybe I can say, what case would you point to as analogous to the facts here? Because as I understand the record, your client was inside the house, never had any direct contact with the gentleman who came back to retrieve the phones and the iPad, didn't overhear what was said. I think the record also is that that individual never made any threats to the husband. So how do we get to a being within a zone of physical danger on this record?
And I apologize, I'm forgetting the name of the case, and I should have had that ready. It's the case where the person was in the next room. The mother and the kid were in the next room.
Homicide case?
The homicide case, correct. That she's close enough as far as that goes. They come to her house. It's her house. She has in her head all of this information about it being a bad person that stole their car. She knows that the car was filled with weird stuff. It smelled like pot. You know, it was filled with all these things, that there's this portfolio that is involved this dangerous person. And so all of that adds together. And again, that goes the idea that this is a strange case in and of itself, but that creates enough if we have to get there. And as I argued before, I don't know that we need to get to zone of danger as far as the issue.
But isn't whether someone's in the zone of danger, I mean, because I can understand how someone could feel that way, how your client could feel that way, but this is isn't that an objective test? And just, that's a lot different than being in, you know, the kind of different room of the house where someone's, you know, violently injured, harmed. I mean, could you help me with that?
Yeah, if the issue is an objective test, and you can see that a person would be affected by the person coming to the house, then I think you can get to that conclusion. You know, if it was completely foreign, or you thought, well, you're not anywhere near what took place, then that would be different. But they came to her house, and I don't know what you'd have to get to. I mean, would she actually have to be standing next to him? Coming to the house is scary enough, I would submit.
But Mr. Bryant, I mean, the zone of danger, I mean, it involves a notion of physical danger. You are in physical danger. And where in this record is there facts that would show that she was in physical danger and reasonably feared for her safety in a physical sense at the time? I mean, even assuming that the negligent conduct includes the people coming to the house afterwards, but at that time.
Well, I think that is the evidence that we have. I mean, we don't have, we have her in her house and a person come to the house that tracks something in the car to get there. They know where she lives. Her husband's out with the person. She knows that there's stuff still in the vehicle. She finds out, you know, that, you know, all the different things that were part of it. So I think that's enough. I mean, that's the fear of the knock on the door or the phone call that people have. And here, this person's actually there. You know, and it's a lady that just had, you know, heart surgery, not that long before this. And it's all because the car got stolen. If the car doesn't get stolen, if they take care of the car and the car comes back, none of this happens. There's no connection. There's no person who takes it. Nothing goes on from there. So that's what we have for evidence, Your Honor. And if I could add something or there isn't, that's it.
It seems to me your briefing, while it makes these assertions, goes beyond and really suggests that the whole zone of danger element is outmoded and that the law should change. And I'm wondering is there something in, for example, the restatement of torts that would get us there or other case law that you would have us point to if, in fact, we would be inclined to establish a new rule of law in this tort area?
Well, I don't know. And I will freely admit that we're in the Court of Appeals. And so some of that is what it is. Basically, that we're laying out the basis for the argument that there's some unfairness that goes on with emotional cases that somehow are different than physical cases. And it's this underlying belief that you need some extra proof that you're mentally injured versus any other case. And all of this we submit should go to a jury, and a jury should weigh it. If the jury doesn't believe it, but that isn't the facts that should be decided by the court. But I will absolutely completely admit the limitations I have in the Court of Appeals and what we've got laid out there.
Again, let me ask this again. Assuming we, understanding the role of our court as an error correcting court and not being inclined to change the law in an area in which our Supreme Court has spoken, but setting that aside, what's the rule of law you would have us announce if we in fact decided to alter the negligent infliction of emotional distress tort as you advocate?
It would be based upon, I think it would be an expansion or at least a, I don't know that I would call it an expansion. It would be looking at this and finding from the earlier question I got about, is there an objective standard here? Finding that there is an objective standard by what took place under the facts. That if people can feel it, if people can acknowledge it, that's enough to get us to that point, that it doesn't have to be as strictly construed as it has. Beyond that, that would be the main basis. As far as wordsmithing it goes, Your Honor, I think it's more of a finding by the court that the mental is more important than it seems to be. This whole issue that, you know, that there has to be limits on what dangers or what damages can be brought isn't really consistent with the law, that the law says if there's damages and there are results from what took place, those should be what looked at by the jury, and then the jury should decide. So I don't know if I answered your question there, Judge, but I gave her a run. Anything else? That's what I got. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bryant. Counsel respondent, we'll turn to you.
May it please the court. My name is Jeff Markowitz and I represent respondent Prestige Parking and Valet LLC. Prestige respectfully asks the court to affirm summary judgment. I think one of the things that bears emphasizing in this appeal is that there are cases that maybe call for re-examining of prior ways. And those are going to be cases where I think if you look at them, you would say, well, but for this one rule, if we changed this rule, the plaintiff would win. And I think we amply describe in our briefing why the rule is what it is. It comes from the Minnesota Supreme Court. There's good policy behind it. But an alternative argument, which bears emphasizing, is the lack of proximate cause argument. It's hard to even describe the facts of this case without describing it as, to borrow words from the prior argument, strange and the sort of thing that you would never expect to see happen again. There's a reason for that. This is just that these are strange facts. And that goes to the proximate cause inquiry, which looks to what would be reasonably foreseeable. Is this just a chain of but-for causes that link something one day prior to 2 days later? And is it so unusual that we wouldn't expect someone to foresee that to occur? And the answer is yes.
Let me stop you there. I mean, maybe this particular set of facts is unusual and you know, we all hope unlikely to recur. But the notion of when you have an item like a car that contains personal effects, you've got your car registration and your proof of insurance that, guess what, has your home address on it. I mean, why is it so far removed that we would say having someone who steals a vehicle due to someone else's negligence could in fact be reasonably foreseeable that they would obtain personal information about the victim of that theft and potentially could have contact with that person? Why is that outside the bounds of foreseeability?
Well, in part because to refer to the premise, there's no factual record that suggests that the brother and the brother's girlfriend obtained personal information from the car, from something that's written down. At least the uncontested premise and seems to be uncontested by plaintiffs is that this was the iPad or this was the iPhone. In the medical records that Ms. Gross pointed to in her reply brief, in that page 15, she even refers to, or Ms. Gross talking about, I think it was the iPad. that led the thief's brother and girlfriend to come and find me. So it that breaks a causal chain. The foreseeability inquiry looks for what sort of chain reaction would be sort of the this led to that, and it was bing, bang, boom. Here we have one prominent intervening cause that didn't have to happen. Two people made a choice a few days later to track down the iPad or the iPhones and to trace it. This didn't lead inexorably or as some chain reaction from the car theft. This was in addition. And this is in a contrast to, Your Honor.
So I want to make sure I understand. So are you agreeing that it's foreseeable that a car thief will be able, could have access and find out where the owner lives? What you're saying, I hear you say, I want to make sure. So that would be foreseeable, but what the intervening, where the intervening cause comes in is, and they went to the house and tried to get things back.
No, Your Honor, I don't think that's just per se foreseeable that a car thief learns where the person who owned the car lives. I bet usually we bring our wallet and our purses with us. So I'm trying to imagine even what sort of information would be in the typical car that would lead to that. And here we know that the thing that led to the finding was something that had nothing to do with what the plaintiff left in her car, but it was what the thief left in the car and the police neglected to seize. It wasn't ultimately the thief the thief that was arrested, at least, who tracked down the vehicle. It was a family member and a friend who tracked down the vehicle, and it was the thief's belongings or their belongings. It wasn't Miss Gross's. So even
I understand your argument. My basic problem is the district court didn't rule on this issue, and as a general rule, we don't get to point to issues that a district court doesn't decide. So I'd like to speak a little bit to the main issue, and that is whether the district court erred by granting summary judgment on the basis that the elements of a negligent infliction claim were not met as a matter of law. Why would we say on this record that it is, as a matter of law, the plaintiff or the appellant was not within the zone of physical danger?
In every single case that I could find, that is been issued by the Minnesota Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals, there has been a physical danger. Just to name a few, Purcell, a train crash that almost happened. In Ocrina, a building that fell down and almost hit Miss Ocrina. In Quill, I believe that was the plane that spun out of control. In the murder case, I believe there was actual murder that took place in the nearby room. Here, there is absolutely zero evidence of a threat of violence, a weapon, a raised voice, anything beyond an uncomfortable situation that may have unfolded, in which the brother and the brother's girlfriend came and said, hey, we'd like our stuff back. And Mr. Gross said, okay. I can appreciate why someone would feel nervous in that situation, saying, I'm not sure what's going on, but just nervousness or that uncertainty, that doesn't transform that someone's machinations or imagination that something could go wrong isn't the physical danger that the Minnesota appellate courts have been talking about. And I guess it's a 0 + 0 = 0, Your Honor. There was no plane, there was no train, there was no explosion, there was no building falling down. It was Ms. Gross being worried about what if, what could happen. And that is simply not the physical danger that the courts have emphasized again and again. I'll read from KAC, which is the second most recent Minnesota Supreme Court case on this. And the court referred to the standard as this way. The zone of danger requires a situation where it was abundantly clear that plaintiff was in grave personal peril for some specifically defined period of time. Fortune smiled and the imminent calamity did not occur. There is zero evidence that there was calamity, let alone one imminent. I could go on, but that goes to that point. I would also point this court to KAC, which I think is at least a CF.instructive. That was the AIDS case in which the court ruled that actual exposure to the AIDS virus and not just fear of that exposure is what is required. I would say that is at least in a different category, on par with the sort of claim that's being made here. We don't just require fear. We say it needs to be fear of something where there was imminent calamity, in that case, a terrible infection and disease.
Why isn't it up to a jury in this case to decide whether the appellant's fears based on her knowledge that these people had come to their house, the fact that her husband says, don't come out here. I mean, isn't that suggestive that he was concerned about physical danger? Why isn't that enough to at least get that question to a jury? Whether the appellant was in the zone of physical danger?
I would query somewhat rhetorically and then answer the question of what is the physical danger? I think if we were to describe what would that physical danger have to be, and as it, throughout time, including most recently in Engler, the Supreme Court referred to it as a physical danger in its decision. What is the physical danger? The physical danger, I imagine, would be violence would break out, there would be fighting, someone would draw a weapon, someone would get hurt. And if we were in a world in which there was some factual basis where a jury could look and say, not just based on feelings or subjective machinations, but actually that was the moment where things could have gone sideways, someone threatened violence, someone pulled a gun. But Ms. Gross was cross-examined on this during her deposition. Every possible question I can imagine. Did you think there was a gun? I had no reason to think there was a gun. None of those things. It can't just be if emotions were enough to provide the physical danger, if a imagined problem were enough, that would blow a giant hole in the zone of physical danger requirement and what it's supposed to do. I would also, I don't need to necessarily go there. I would be happy to speak to the consequences of withdrawing the zone of physical danger rule. Judge Bjorken, you were asking some questions about what would be the alternative rule. And I think it's instructive that, and I think I accurately say it, where my reading of Ms. Gross's brief is that she's asking for a give me the elements and nothing more, basic elements of negligence, and let's just send it to a jury. I would point this court's attention to Engler. And Engler cites what I would describe as the California experiment. In California, one of its central cases on bystander foreseeability theory, which is the more liberal test, is Dillon, D-I-L-L-O-N. Engler cites then to Thing, that's the Thing decision from roughly 30 years later, where the same California Supreme Court takes stock of what Dillon had wrought. And it says that, you know, we made this decision in Dillon. We thought it was going to be okay. We thought we could just, you know, loosen up the restrictions, allow more readily access to emotional distress damages. And it has not gone well. Just reading to you our Minnesota Supreme Court's quoting of what was said in the Thing. The court sought to rein in the ever widening liability that lower courts' expansive interpretations of Dillon's foreseeability test had produced, noting that foreseeability alone does not provide a meaningful restriction on the scope of the NIED action. Thing goes on to say, if you look at the decision directly, it is apparent that reliance on foreseeability of injury alone in finding a duty and thus a right to recovery is not adequate when the damages sought are for an intangible injury. And then Thing starts using language that is exactly reminiscent of what the Supreme Court has said in Stadler. In order to avoid limitless liability out of all proportion to the degree of a defendant's negligence, and against which it is impossible to insure without imposing unacceptable costs on those among whom the risk is spread, the right to recover for negligently caused emotional distress must be limited. It's just one example.
Counsel, how do you respond to the appellant's argument that we don't even need to go down this road about negligent infliction of emotional distress, because in fact, he pleaded out and the evidence supports a claim that his client sustained physical injury and that the emotional distress is really an attendant manifestation of the physical injury. So we would just be looking at the four elements of a negligence claim.
I have found that argument difficult to get my head around for appellant has seemingly used the word the series of events to try to sort of blur over approximate cause issue. We say, well, the series of events wasn't just when the negligence happened, but it was some chain reaction spread across multiple actors, police, Mr. Gross's decision to turn down Mr. Snauberger's offer to remove items, and the taking and the thief's siblings bringing all those devices or tracking down the devices. By calling this all the series of events, we're trying to sort of say, because there were physical manifestations days later from emotional distress from events days later, we can say that that is some physical harm that takes us out of this world, that that would I would point this court's attention to Lick, the Supreme Court's decision in Lichtig. Lichtig was the decision where the Supreme Court did a nice cataloging of the four different avenues by which a plaintiff may recover for emotional distress in Minnesota. And two of those are negligence claims. One of them is for the negligence claim where you have the physical injury and there's the incidental emotional distress, and then there's the NIAD claim. If a physical injury that only follows emotional distress were enough to remove something from the scope of an NIAD claim, that would all but eliminate the need to ever plead under an NIAD claim. I mean, an element of NIAD is you have physical manifestations of the emotional distress. If the physical manifestations freed you of the constraints of NIAD elements, that we wouldn't have NIAD claims anymore, and that law would be gone. I don't think there's any dispute here, and I'm not hearing any dispute that reversing or overruling Minnesota Supreme Court precedents for the court. And I would urge, though, that any, if we're looking at the question of whether to encourage that sort of change from the Supreme Court, it must be viewed through the lens of stare decisis, looking for that compelling reason that says, notwithstanding what was decided before, we're going to go another way. And I think it's instructive that when we look at all the cases from Purcell to Engler, we see that historic caution that the Supreme Court has expressly invoked multiple times when it comes to emotional distress. Ms. Gross has referred to claims of bias and arbitrary decision-making. I don't see that. In preparation for today's oral argument, I read all of those decisions, one after another. What you see is careful decision-making, looking to other jurisdictions and saying, we want to provide means for recovery for these plaintiffs, but we also recognize that defendants have rights to justice and an objective standard as well. And we need a judicial process that's predictable. We need objective standards. And we think that that balance is best struck through the zone of danger test. And I haven't heard anything in the briefing or from other jurisdictions that suggests that that is misplaced. If the court has no further questions, I thank you for your time.
Further questions from the panel? Then Mr. Bryant, we'll turn to you for rebuttal.
Thank you. A couple things. The question got to it, but the respondents continue to ignore the physical injury part of it. They argued it some there. We've got a doctor that says she does have physical injuries. He diagnosed it. Her testimony is consistent with that. The elements of Quill say that if you have a physical injury, you don't go further than that. So I'd submit that should...
Mr. Bryant, if I can just ask, I think I heard Mr. Markowitz say that I think it was Lichtig, that case, he basically came with a first-in-time test. I know I'm paraphrasing. I apologize. Could you respond to that? That, you know, it only counts as if the physical injury is first-in-time.
I apologize, Your Honor. It's still a physical injury, and that's what Quill says you need. If you get a physical injury, that's the first step, and you stop there. And to argue, you know, it's not fair or that somehow that doesn't say that doesn't get you there. So I'd submit that we do meet that. They ignore the beginning argument, which is that this is simply a negligence claim. And to argue that, well, it's fair overall to the defendant. The foreseeability issue is that they're parking cars for people in a hospital. So they know people are vulnerable to begin with when they park the car. That's what I spent so much time with every single person from the parking for the defendants in talking about. That's the foreseeability. The foreseeability, as far as the rest of it goes, foreseeability is that we should take care of your car. We take your car. We should take care of your car. We didn't. And we understand that people are in there in horrible state and they can have an effect. We argue and we point out in our brief that everybody may not be affected in the same way. And that's what I meant by the strangeness and the difference in this case, because most parking lots don't involve hospitals in the majority. And she was in there for a heart procedure. You put that together, I'd submit we have a negligence claim. If we have to go to the negligence infliction under Quill, we get that first element, which is a physical injury, and that should allow us to go forward. Third, as far as if we go all the way to the third point, I'd submit that that last question that was asked of the defendant about the issue of weighing this for a jury, is there a, should, did the court, the district court, make a fact finding that should have been made by the jury? That's our argument if we get all the way to the third element. The jury should be asked those things. And if the jury comes back and says she's not damaged at heart or she shouldn't have been damaged that much and she has no value as far as the case goes, that's all we're asking for, is the right to be able to do that, which goes back to the very start of their argument, which is somehow this is a plaintiff win. All I'm asking for is a right to get, let my client's case be heard, the, based upon the facts in this case. And I'd submit under each of the three points that I've had earlier, we should be allowed to go forward. Any other questions?
Anything more from the panel?
Great. Thank you.
Well, we thank you both very much for your helpful arguments and your thoughtful briefing. We'll take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time period.
Thank you.
And with that, we will end our oral arguments for today.